This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. The welfare of children under state supervision in Vermont has been under scrutiny in the last year. The homicide of 2-year-old Desiree Sheldon in February sparked outrage, partly because Sheldon's family had been previously investigated for abuse. That anger was compounded last spring when another young child, Peyton Girard, was killed. His family had also been in the DCF system. These deaths sparked several investigations and reviews, including one by the state's Citizen Advisory Board. The board was asked to look into whether child protection workers followed procedures in these two cases, whether the established procedures were adequate, and to offer any observations that could help the state improve. The board issued its report on Friday. It's a damning review that says the state's systems failed these two young children at every level. This morning, I talked with the co-chair of the Citizens Advisory Board, Burlington pediatrician Joseph Hagen. Before we dove into the report's findings, he offered this caveat.
I think it has to be seen in the context of the fact that this is incredibly complex work, incredibly difficult work. And I want to be quick to point out that although we found things that we could do better, and we found things that we want to do better, from these cases, we also found that the workers involved certainly met the standard of care. You know, a separate investigation by the Attorney General's office found no criminal negligence on the part of anyone involved. We looked at where the decisions made in a way that was consistent with standard of care, and they were. However, could we learn from them? Could we do them better? Absolutely. And that's what those 40-some recommendations are about.
Let me push you on that a little bit, because certainly you weren't charged with looking at any kind of criminal negligence from DCF workers. And I hear that you're at pains to say that people who work in this system, by and large, are doing it because they, too, want to care for children and want to make sure that children are protected. But even in your own report, you say that in the case of Desiree Sheldon, the caseworker fell short.
Yes.
You said right here on page 10, the case record indicates that the supervised visits conducted by the DCF worker did not meet the department's own standards.
That is correct. It's a direct statement, but it was a nuanced finding.
Mm-hmm.
And what that gets at is that the home visits that were done to try to ascertain the appropriateness of returning her to her mother were done in an environment that really was not the home. Did not take fully into account the other adults who were going to be present, namely mother's boyfriend, who has since been charged. And that is a deficiency. Now, I think that work, that difficult work, requires judgment. I think that was an incorrect judgment. Did the worker feel that she adequately assessed that family? I think that she did. I haven't asked her that because that was the role of the AG's people. But as best we could tell, she was doing her job. Now, with 20/20 hindsight, we can see right away where the deficiency was. So, yes, the statement that you quoted stands, but I think there's nuance there.
Mm-hmm.
This is very hard work. And one of the things that we wanted to get at with the report was to point out where the deficiencies were, and you've highlighted an important one, but also look at why that deficiency occurred and what we can do differently.
Right. And to that end, let's talk about that, because there are recommendations that go along with what you found that was inadequate, insufficient, or wrong in these cases. So looking at just the Desiree Sheldon case that we're talking about, and that idea that the supervised visits weren't adequate, the judgment may have been wrong, and they weren't done in a way that allowed for caseworkers to understand family dynamics. So some of the things that you recommend, if other people besides a biological parent are living in the household, perhaps they should also be interviewed and considered when it comes to placement of the child and safety of the child.
Yes, and I think being very concrete about that moves that away from judgment to now standard operating procedure.
So if somebody else is in the house, a boyfriend, a girlfriend, whatever, they are considered part of the household, they also need to be evaluated. That's a recommendation.
That's a recommendation, precisely. I think the recommendations, really fall under several areas. You know, one is, the idea of supervision of caseworkers. Recognizing that in the past, I think 7 years, there have been 44 cases that we define as serious. That's not a whole lot of cases. And so one caseworker might not have dealt with these before. They need a different level of supervision than was available at that time. And that's already been put into place by DCF. I think a second, the tremendously important area is workload.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the national goal is 12 active cases per worker. The state's goal, set 2 or 3 years ago, was 12 active cases per worker. Right now we have 16. That's 33% more than 100% work. These, as I said earlier, are incredibly complex cases. So to spread our workers thin on these cases is an error. And that's an error that we as community, you know, have allowed, and I think that we have to correct.
That staffing issue, the Department for Children and Families did add, I think, 18 caseworkers, but that has not lightened their load because they're investigating more cases now. And you say in the report, we need more money and more caseworkers, perhaps to help avoid burnout and turnover. There's 20% turnover in the system, and that needs to change as well.
Correct. You've got it in a nutshell. I mean, we need probably 40 more workers.
40.
DCF could tell you how many workers they need to reach that number, but you know, it's in that range. We're not talking peanuts here. We're talking a significant number of highly trained professionals to do this work in the field, to do this work in a supervisory function. You know, remember, 10 years ago, we did a lot of changes within the agency and within DCF, and a lot of the supervisory functions that existed, you know, 10, 15 years ago, over time were truncated, were combined, and were cut. You know, we need to return to that level and more in terms of caseworkers, in terms of supervision, so that we have the depth and breadth that we need to address these difficult cases.
Do you think the legislature is going to go for that? I mean, 40 more caseworkers, 40 more staffers at DCF, that's a lot of money in a state where we're continuing to see budget shortfalls.
Exactly, and that's a huge issue, because one of the things that you'll also see in the section on recommendations about for the courts is the courts are understaffed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the third point that I wanted to make in terms of essential change is the need for stronger communication between the professionals involved here. Now, part of that is understanding of the rules of confidentiality in these cases. You know, more information can be shared than people assume can be shared. But a second point is making sure that we have the laws to support the sharing of information between concerned professionals in these cases. This is a very important issue, Jane, because we're talking about, you know, very private things within families. It's not the sort of thing that pediatricians usually discuss with colleagues, because, you know, confidentiality would dictate that that's inappropriate. But the laws say that there are certain exceptions to that when you're talking about the need for multidisciplines to work to serve children who are in state custody, children who've been adjudicated as at risk. And then the third area is recognizing that the court system is so overstressed itself, so understaffed itself, that the ability to have a conversation before moving into the courtroom between the social worker, perhaps involving the physician or other professional who reported the case, it's done quickly now, and this is not something that should be done on the fly. People try very hard. People do excellent work, but if they, you know, had a chance to do it in a more contemplative fashion, that would be to children's advantage. That would be to families' advantages. You know, the goal here is to strengthen these families and make them stronger. The goal here is not to remove kids and fail to reunify when we can, when it is in the child's best interest. But that requires, you know, staff having the ability to work together. So the communication within the system and DCF and with outside of DCF system to the court system, to medical systems, you know, we need to strengthen, you know, that communication as well.
But it seems like it's the system and checks and balances that's off. You know, you do say through the report, every part of this system, there were failures. Had one part of the system worked better, something might have been different. Had the court system worked better, had law enforcement worked better and been able to communicate that point about communication, that if everybody could see every piece of this, there might have been different outcomes. Reunification might not have happened. You know, if medical personnel had had more training to perhaps see some of this stuff, if caseworkers had better understanding of how manipulative drug abusers can be, you know, that in every in every instance, in almost, it seemed like there was a missed sign or a missed signal.
I think that's a very fair summary and analysis. I think that, and these were two tragic cases that drew our attention to this in a critical way, that we needed to look at this. But there are other cases of equal complexity, not at this level of severity, thank God, but equal complexity, who will benefit from us, you know, having adequate numbers of workers, having adequate supervision of those workers, having training for those workers and for law enforcement. You know, there are many areas that we need to expand this. You know, it'd be good to have dedicated state's attorneys, social workers to help in the court system. So that when cases go to court, there's already been extensive communication between DCF, between the state's attorney, between a guardian ad litem if there is one, so that the state's understanding of the child's best interests are clearly presented to the judge, so the judge can make these incredibly difficult decisions. You know, there's a whole lot of areas that we could do better.
One other area that I want to mention, because it came up in a lot of different places in the report, is this area and issue of reunification and this idea that caseworkers often seemed to think that reunification with the birth family was an overarching goal of the department. It sounds like from the department's own procedures, it is a goal if it's in the best interest of the children. But that's clearly not being communicated, that part of if it's in the best interest of the children. Because what you found was that caseworkers thought that is the goal. That's the, we are working towards that almost at all costs.
So it's a very complex issue, which has been distilled down to the recommendation that you just cited. The complexity comes from the fact that the federal guidelines mandate that reunification with the biologic parents or with bonded family members, you know, should be the first goal. Federal funds are tied to that type of outcome. There are federal mandates on how quickly the courts move these cases through. So that is not just a state mandate. That is a federal mandate. There is great interest now in making sure that every possibility to strengthen the biologic family is done before a child is removed. So it's a very complex issue. As I say, I've yet to meet a worker who didn't understand that the best interests of the child were the final deciding factor. But the culture is different than it was 10 years ago, where you did your best to help the family, and if you couldn't, well, they were put up for adoption or left in foster care for a long period of time. I think the federal intention was to keep kids out of, you know, permanent foster care, family after family after family. And I think the unintended consequence was that there was a national overemphasis on reunification, not just here in Vermont. We needed to back off and say, you know, yes, reunification is always our goal, but the trump factor, the final deciding factor, is where will that child be safe? What are the best interests of the child? And there's a balance there. We certainly don't want to have a state that has a very itchy trigger finger to remove children from their families. Families have a right to privacy. Families have a right to parent their children as they see fit, as long as they are providing for their children in a caring and loving and non-abusive way. It's very complex, and yes, I think that we need to now step back and say, yes, reunification should always be our goal, but we should always remember that it will not necessarily be an achieved goal if it is in the child's best interest and the child's best safety to be put up for adoption.
It's difficult to think about all of these places where the system failed these two specific children, Peyton Girard and Desiree Sheldon. Two helpless, innocent, very young children died because our policies weren't followed and were inadequate to begin with. That's the evaluation of this report. And no matter how many dedicated and compassionate people work for DCF and for the system, the system failed these children in addition to their loved ones failing these children. It's very hard to read about and very hard to think about real children in this situation. So one hopes that this report that you and your colleagues have worked on makes some difference. And you've mentioned that DCF is already making some changes on their own. But what happens now? Because other children are being abused by their families and are at risk.
Yeah, I think you've hit on it exactly. There is a system failure, but what is the system? I mean, I think, yes, the system is DCF, and yes, the system is law enforcement, and yes, the system is courts, but the system is us. It's us. You know, part of the tragedy of these two cases is our inability as community to support these families. One of the mothers spent, both these mothers spent tremendous time seeking housing. Housing, okay? Both these mothers had a lot of demons in their life and a lot of struggles, but if we could not find them a place to live, you know, that adds to the stress. That adds to the that's another demon. You know, I think that if we're going to make a substantial change in child abuse deaths and in the occurrence of child abuse, we're going to have to put a lot of energy into first prevention. You know, it's wonderful we now have preschool beginning at age 4, but 90% of a child's brain is developed by age 3, you know? So what happens in the first 3 years are the most crucial years in terms of looking to what's going to happen to that child's neurologic and life outcome. You know, we need more home visiting for infants. You know, we need more support services and quality child care that's affordable so that when parents need to return to work, they can return to work. We need to respond before families are struggling so much that they get reported to DCF. And when they get reported to DCF, we need to be able to respond in a way that is child-centered, family-centered. And those are the tough decisions that we're going to have to make moving forward. How are we going to achieve those things? It's going to have a cost.
That's Dr. Joseph Hagen, co-chair of the Vermont Citizens Advisory Board. I spoke with him this morning about the report the board has just issued. It detailed how Vermont's child protection system failed in the cases of toddlers Desiree Sheldon and Peyton Girard. They were both victims of homicide, allegedly at the hands of abusive family members. We have a link to the full report at vpr.net. And next Tuesday, we'll continue this discussion with the Commissioner of the Department for Children and Families, Ken Schatz. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. This is the time of year when many of us start to reflect on the importance of family, of community, and of giving. Especially this week, as Thanksgiving approaches, we think about our shared existence and remind ourselves to be grateful for all that is good in our lives and to work to improve what we can about the injustices of the world. The anxiety over what we will serve at our Thanksgiving table seems trivial by comparison, but it's nonetheless a preoccupation many of us share. If you've been wondering what wine you can bring to your Friendsgiving or to your family dinner, something that will go with turkey but still be appealing to vegan palates, something that's not going to break the bank and yet tastes like a million bucks, our guests today can help you out. Kevin Clayton is the owner of Village Wine and Coffee in Shelburne, and Kevin Ring is the wine director at Twin Farms Resort in Barnard. They are back by popular demand after you all had so many questions for them the last time they were on the show. Kevin and Kevin, welcome back.
Good afternoon.
Thanks, Jane. Thrilled.
And listeners, now is the time for all those wine questions. You've got a couple of days now before Thanksgiving. Maybe you haven't purchased your wine. Maybe you're not sure if you're going to have wine at all. Well, if you have a question about that or some niggling question about wine that's been bothering you for years, you can call now 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Let's talk about one of the seasonal wines that comes around at this time of year. I saw the first bottles of Beaujolais Nouveau on the shelves and in shops just a couple days ago now. Kevin Clayton, I saw you. I don't know what that expression is. Not rolling your eyes, but sort of half laughing.
I don't even have any in my shop.
Why not?
Well, I like Gamay, the grape that Beaujolais Nouveau is based upon. I really like the sort of better, higher quality ones. The Nouveau is always fun and exciting, and actually I completely forgot to order any this time. So, and we do have some really good Gamays. It's a great food wine. Most of the Beaujolais Nouveau is all about celebrating the harvest. And it was always I think the British started it, a race to see who got the first bottle back across the channel, and then they opened it up. So it was sort of this big celebration. Everything's been buttoned up. Everything's been finished, and let's just enjoy the fruits of working really hard. So that's, I think, the history of it. And
And it's a young wine. It's a wine that's been bottled 6 or 8 weeks ago,
right? Yeah, it's made fresh. It's made to be drunk within the first year you buy it. It's just like lower alcohol, easy drinking, knock it back. It sort of just makes it's just sort of almost like a picnic kind of wine.
And you don't have any in your shop just because you forgot or because you don't like it?
Well, there are a few I found that I like, and actually this year I absolutely totally forgot about it.
Kevin Ring, what do you think, too? What do you think about the Beaujolais Nouveau?
Well, I guess I'm sort of rolling my eyes a little bit, too, but I didn't bring any in. But the issue for me is I think it's really given a really legitimate grape varietal Gamay a bit of a bad name because it became a bit of, a gimmick. I understand why. I love Gamay. Cru Beaujolais, Gamay from the Loire, flavor-wise, are perfect for wines. You know, you think about Thanksgiving dinner. I heard actually earlier on Point when you had the chefs on, they talk about the lack of acidity on the Thanksgiving menu. And it was like, great, you can make up for that with wine. And, you know, I'm a big fan of acidity in food wines. A good Beaujolais, maybe from, you know, a Cru Beaujolais or something from the Loire, is going to have that fruit and it's going to be backed up with those sour cherry notes and the acidity. And I think so that's kind of why I'm rolling my eyes too at the Nouveau.
And a Nouveau, I mean, there's nobody who's been tasting it before you have if you're buying it on Beaujolais Day. So everybody's trying to figure out at the same time whether it's good or not good, depending on, you know, which Beaujolais it is, right? So, I mean, that's kind of fun, even if it's a little bit gimmicky, right?
Yeah, well, maybe that's why Kevin forgot.
I heard 2014 was a good vintage, at least from a winemaker I know from Bordeaux. She was completely pleased with what she got. Again, there's a ton of weather challenges, again, all over France. So sometimes it's hit or miss, but it's usually just the freshness of the quality of the drink. And it's just like, yay, we're here, so let's have it.
Okay, but you both have said you really like the Gamay grape that this wine comes from. So what would you recommend for somebody who wants that grape variety in a wine that you guys would recommend? Kevin Ring.
I would go see somebody like Kevin or go to your local wine shop and say, look, I really want to have a Cru Beaujolais. I want to have something from one of the different crus in Beaujolais, which is just a southern part of Burgundy. Gamay is similar in style and weight to Pinot Noir from Burgundy. And let them pick you. Have them pull something out for you, and you're going to be very surprised. It's not as sort of sweet and bubblegummy as the Nouveau is and is going to have some real legitimate values to it.
All right, Kevin Clayton, so if they come to your shop, first of all, what's a cru?
Okay, so when a cru is referred to, usually, like, for example, Beaujolais is an area, and then a cru usually is all the little different towns. And all the little different towns have different soils and different properties, and some can be super minerally, some can be big and fruity and rich, and some can be brambly. Like, I would almost pick a Morgon, because a Morgon's got a nice weight to it. It's very similar to Pinot Noir or Red Burgundy. There's a nice weight to it. There's good acidity, but it's not so big it's going to interfere with your table, because when we're talking about Thanksgiving, you want to be able to taste your food, taste your wine, and go back and taste your food. So it's sort of like the wine cleanses the palate, adds the acidity to help digestion, but you can go back and forth. So it's the going back and forth and having the fun, like trying different things. And sort of Morgon is a lovely sort of lighter weight. Well, it's actually got some weight to it, but it's not heavy-handed like, say, a Cabernet or a Malbec. And you can sort of I think it works good at the table.
We're talking about wines today. We're looking at what wines might pair with the holiday dinners that you're anticipating or what questions you might have about wine. A lot of people worried about their wine knowledge and perhaps feel a little inadequate when you're going to a dinner party, perhaps with people who know more about wine. So if you have a question you'd like to have answered, our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Tell us what you're serving for Thanksgiving and maybe ask Kevin or Kevin what would pair really well with it. Or see if you can stump them. Again, 1-800-639-2211. We got a note from Winston who asks, which wine would go best with tofurkey? Which one of you wants to tackle that?
I saw that on the Facebook page. I was like, okay, so here's the challenge. I think when you think about Thanksgiving meal, there are so many different flavors there. It doesn't matter if you're having a turkey, deep fried, smoked, tofurkey. Like Kevin said, you want to have something that is going to complement everything. Biggest thing to do is stay away from wines that have lots of tannins because you don't have a heavy flavors or heavy fat on a Thanksgiving table, especially if you're a vegetarian.
Wait a minute. Heavy fat. I mean, we got a lot of heavy fat at some Thanksgiving tables.
I'm talking about you're not having a veal chop. So you want to have something that has acidity and has fruit, but you know isn't big tannin-wise. And a colleague of mine pointed out the other day that he really likes Zinfandel. At Thanksgiving, and I thought about it, and I did a tasting with some guests last week, and we tried one. If you think about a Zinfandel, it's going to be brambly. It's going to have big fruit. It's going to have the acidity, but it doesn't have a lot of tannins, so it's going to work really well. I think, you know, something like a Gamay, maybe a wine from Austria or Oregon Pinot Noir from the red side is going to work really well with the tofurkey. Whites, stuff from the Jura.
Kevin, are you working on Thanksgiving or do you get to have a friend or a family Thanksgiving yourself?
I'm working.
So you don't get to have that table that you're creating yourself. What would you serve if you could?
Well, I'm creating a table for 40 house guests and I've got my wines picked and ready to pour. So, yeah, I mean, I get, you know, and we will certainly share a meal with the staff after we feed our guests. You know, I'm pouring a white from the Jura, a Sauvignon, and then I just got a 6-liter bottle of Chateauneuf du Pape that I'm going to be serving our guest. And in sneaking in the middle, we're leaving out rosé, which is not just a summer wine. Rosé, to me, year-round. Kevin and I were talking before we came in. We're both a big fan of a rosé out of Austria, a sparkling rosé of Pinot Noir, which is you can drink right through the meal, and I have in the past.
Kevin Clayton, what are you doing for Thanksgiving?
I'm actually going to have some lunch with some great people who are really good chefs. It's all vegetarian, and then having a family dinner in the evening. And I'm kind of looking forward to Nebbiolo-based wine. I love the wines from the Piedmont because they just have that acidity without the weight. When you said tofurkey, the ones I've had are made with mushrooms. So there's lots of fun things that go with mushrooms. And sort of, I certainly feel like Barberas and Nebbiolos are nice complements to something with the mushroom. And in terms of what Kevin said about Zinfandel, I would kind of look for, there's some that are made at higher elevation. So they're really minerally and they're almost Bordeaux-like and they don't have that big fruit, but they have this beautiful presence in the mouth. Again, taste food, taste wine, and not have one or the other mask the flavors. So you really can enjoy yourself through the whole meal.
So when you think about wines, I mean, Kevin Ring just also mentioned rosé. And Kevin Clayton, I know you, the last time you were on the show, you were singing the praises of rosé. Still on it?
Absolutely. I still got a bunch in my cellar. And actually, the ones from the summer, if you'd put them away, the acidity drops a little bit and there's this roundness to the fruit comes up. But again, they have enough flavor to be interesting and satisfying. And then they're not so heavy that they keep adding. You know, if you look at Thanksgiving, you just have these courses, tons of food. And you just don't want to keep adding bulk and keep adding more and more and more and more. So I think certainly at the beginning of the meal, if you can have a beautiful sparkly wine or a light rosé or light white wine, you're just kind of building up, and then you can progress to something maybe a little heavier with a meal. But you're not going to load up. You're not going to load up your system.
We got a question from Wendy who says, I've always wondered about the less expensive wines and whether or not these are made from extracts rather than in the traditional way. You see a label saying crafted sometimes and you wonder. So, Kevin Ring, what's going on there? I mean, Wendy's wondering about less expensive wines and about the process.
Well, you're going to open up a sort of a bit of a can of worms here with me when it comes to wine and what goes into wine. We've talked about it before. I don't know if I hit on it last time. USDA allows, you know, almost 400 different things to be put in wine. Doesn't have to go on the label.
Like answer, what? So things like what that might be in the wine that you don't know about?
Stabilizers, added tannins, added sugars, added acidity, cleansers, stabilizers, things that are helping feed the cultivated yeast that is used as opposed to the natural yeast that is used in winemaking process, but most of it is not going to be extracted. It's going to be a fermented grape product. You know, the more industrial ones, I use the term fermented grape product, not wine. Lower price doesn't necessarily mean lower quality, though. I mean, there is certainly good wine out there that can be had for that, you know, that either side of $10 range. It doesn't have to be bad.
So how do you know the difference then if you're a regular consumer who may or may not be in a position to ask one of the Kevins for help? Is there any way to know if you're, let's say you're buying your wine at a grocery store, you're buying everything, you just got a couple minutes, how do you know?
Well, I'm going to start off by saying don't buy your wine at a grocery
store.
And you knew that. And you've got to create a relationship with somebody. We, you know, here in Vermont, we talk about buying local. Well, okay, so buy your wine from a local wine shop.
You don't always have that opportunity. So how do you, I mean, if are there ways to just tell on a label if you don't have somebody there? Or you go to a wine shop and the person isn't knowledgeable.
Okay, you're going to push me,
Jane. I'm going to push you, yeah.
This
is a news show, Kevin.
Spin the bottle around and look at the importer. Start to know if the importer is similar as on wines you like. You're like, wow, I really like this wine. You spin it around. You're like, oh, it's ABC Imports. I really like the wines of ABC Imports. Not always going to work, but at least look at that. If you are not going to take the effort to make a relationship with a Kevin Clayton, then at least do some of your own homework.
And Kevin Clayton, so if somebody does come in to see you and they say, well, I feel like I need something that's more expensive so that I know it's good. How do you counsel them about price points and what a price actually represents?
Winemaking is so good right now. Like Kevin said, you can get great wines for $10. So the reality is like someone like in a position like myself, we try everything. We actually try everything. And then in terms of like understanding an importer, there are importers that do their homework and they represent small farmers and they're really good. So I think the answer is there's great wine in every price point. And the first question I ask people is how many people you got coming, what's your budget, and then how comfortable are you being, you know, do you want to try something different? What do you like? Or even if what they like, can we find you something in a similar way to what you like, but maybe something different if you're interested in trying something more? And there is so much good wine out there right now. There's actually more than you could even imagine. But you do have to go with the sort of smaller producers. I think you'll have better quality and you won't have to worry about what's in the bottle.
So why is it, though, that some wines are $10 and some wines are $300? What's the actual difference beyond just hype?
I think you hit on it right there. A lot of it is the hype. And I work at a level, too, where it's not just $300. The ceiling is very, very high.
What's the most expensive bottle you have?
I'm not going to go there. It's just not cool. But I think a lot of it is the higher-end wine industry has turned into, to me, it's a luxury product. It's a lot of it. And you see it with the craft brews and you see all that. It's about I can get it. I have the resources to afford it. I have the connections to get it. I am more impressed by somebody who can come in, who can come into a restaurant environment or a retail environment, find a bottle of wine that's going to really work at the price point they want, than somebody that can chunk down a big amount of money on a bottle of wine. It just doesn't do it for me.
So when you're trying to figure out what to put on your wine list, you're not looking at price as one of the considerations to think about what might make it a quality wine. That sort of comes later.
Like Kevin said, I taste everything. I mean, purveyors come to me. I don't buy it unless I taste it. I did inherit a pretty big cellar at my new property, and it has been thought through and it has got some big hitters there. I certainly use those. I work around them, but I use that as the anchor, like the main course wine. You know, I'm giving somebody something, a ta-da moment, then I get to bring out a Dolcetto or a Gamay or a Zsufark from Hungary and turn somebody onto something. I get to push them out of that box because I get to pick what they're drinking.
We're talking today about wine. We're looking at what you might be able to pair with some of your holiday dinners. And our Kevins are answering your questions about any wine-related issues you may have wondered about for years. What makes a quality wine? How do you know what to pair with the food that you're serving? If you have a question, our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at VPR.net. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm, and today we're talking wine with Kevin Clayton from Village Wine and Coffee in Shelburne and Kevin Ring from Twin Farms Resort in Barnard. They're sharing their knowledge of wine and food, and they're here to help if you have a holiday wine question or any other wine question. You can give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211 or post online at VPR.net. What scares you you about wines. What would you like to know that would give you more confidence to order wine in a restaurant? Again, 1-800-639-2211. And let's go to Carol Ann calling in from Sudbury. Hi, Carol Ann. Go ahead.
Hi there. We were given a nice decanter, a Riedel decanter, and I'm not really sure what red wines to be using with it.
All right. So Kevin or Kevin, which one of you wants to tackle that? Kevin Clayton.
Decanters are great. I was actually thinking of this before I came here. So many people come in, and I actually try to recommend to them, right when you start cooking, open your red wine for dinner. If you don't have a decanter, open it up. If you do have a decanter, if it's a big red wine, and it's a young red wine, it's a great idea to put it in it. And you can even put it in the fridge for a half an hour before you serve your dinner so it drops it down to about 60 degrees. It's adding, let's put it this way, this is a living product that's in a bottle. And you pull the cork out and it's kind of almost gasping for some air, not much, but some. And that will help flesh out a lot of the flavors. So with old wines, it's a great thing. If it's a wine that hasn't been filtered or fined, it's a great way. You stand up the old wine a couple of days ahead of time, and then, you know, there's a technique of using a candle in a bottle, looking through it, and there's a way to put it in the decanter to keep the sludge and the bad bits out of it into the other thing. Also, it's a presentation. You've got a lovely red wine, and to see all that beautiful color is another thing to do. And I wouldn't decant necessarily Pinot Noir or Red Burgundies. It seems like trying to add that extra oxygen, they're more delicate, and that kind of shakes them up a little bit much. But some of the bigger grapes, Malbec, Cabernet, some Red Bordeaux, Zinfandels, they do fine in a decanter.
And basically they just want to breathe. That's the point.
Yeah, you know, some people sell aerators. I won't sell them. I think they put too much oxygen in wine, unlike some really delicate wines. But It's more about just sort of like letting it come out. Like mm-hmm. It's been there. Wine always tastes better at the end of the meal when you've had it in a restaurant, right? So it had an hour to get some air. So why not give it some air to begin with, and then you can really start enjoying it with the beginning of your meal.
We got a question from Adrian who says, I am making duck for Thanksgiving with a citrus paprika crust. Also potatoes, pumpkin salad, stuffing, etc. What wine should I serve? What do you think, Kevin Ring?
Oregon Pinot Noir. You know, or any Pinot Noir, but I use Pinot Noir, especially Oregon Pinot Noir, whenever we have duck for dinner at Twin Farms. It's just a match made in heaven. I mean, that those sour cherry notes, the little bit of back pepper, black pepper in the backside work really, really, really well. And, you know, that dish right there is screaming Oregon Pinot Noir.
Any one in particular that really catches your fancy? I know you're not in the habit of just promoting certain wines, but what would you suggest?
I caught a lot of heat last time when I threw a plug in for somebody.
Did you really?
Yeah, out there in the industry. So, I would say Oregon is a good way to go. I don't want to name names.
Kevin Clayton, do you feel the same way?
Well, they're favorites. People have your favorites. And there's also favorites for me based on people I've met or what they're doing for farming techniques. For example, I'll say Christom. Steve Dorner worked with Calera. He's growing wines just like Burgundy, like when you talked about pricing. I don't think people know it costs like in Oregon, it certainly costs like $3 an acre just to farm an acre. Now, he's doing 2,500 plants an acre. It costs him $10 a bottle just to farm that. Now, we're not talking picking, harvesting, bottles, fermentation, all that stuff. So then you start to see why a wine costs $30, $40. But this guy, it's all about the farming. And he's a minimalist interventionalist. And I think pretty much if you ask anybody who's an Oregon winemaker, when you ask them what do they drink when they go out, they go, I drink Christom wines. So I don't have a problem particularly plugging this because I met him. He's a wonderful man. He's a brilliant farmer. And that's what we're talking about here is a farm product that's it's in a bottle, but it's the same kind of farm product that you got on the rest of your table. So how do you honor that? And hopefully by supporting someone who in the tradition of great winemaking is trying to also do that. So not that.
Let's go to Sabra, who's calling in from Verscher. Hi, Sabra. Go ahead.
Hi, Jane, and hi, Kevin and Kevin. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to put a plug in for hard ciders because they're really sort of the original drink of New England. As everybody knows, it's Johnny Appleseed's story. We've been making hard cider for 30 years, and ours are super bone dry. And the other wonderful thing about cider for a long Thanksgiving meal is that like Amanda Hester said from the New York Times, can port a lot of flavor for the volume of alcohol. Ours are 9.5%. We do a sparkling that's a true champagne method. And, you know, you could start off your day, your afternoon with maybe Jasper Hill cheeses or whatever with our sparkling champagne and go on and use a red wine later or even we make three different kinds. But I just wanted to put a plug out for cider. There's a wide range. Some of them are called into breweries, but ours is actually a very slow, cold fermentation process. It's like 2 years. And so, you know, we're getting a lot of complexity and bone dry. So
Sabra, thank you for sharing that. I appreciate hearing about your ciders. That's Sabra from Flag Hill Farm talking about her cider method. And, you know, there is this wide variety, especially of local ciders, coming into the fore right now. And I'm wondering, for both of you, if that's something that you think about. I mean, you know, Kevin Clayton, your shop is focused on wine, but you do offer some other products. Do you think about hard ciders coming into
the... Absolutely. I have hard ciders on the shelf. And what Sabra was talking about, which is really great, is I actually have a completely non-alcoholic French dry sparkling cider. For someone who isn't drinking alcohol, it's a great food wine, again, because it's got nice acidity, the sugar's low in it, it's not going to interfere. What Sabra was talking about with only a 9.5% alcohol, that's not much more than a strong beer. So it's something that actually is not going to interfere with any of the food. It's got really nice acidity, and it's actually quite a nice complement to a lot of food. So we do carry... you know, I probably have about 5 or 6 different types. And I think it's actually for some people who don't like wine, it's a great beverage. It's a great beverage that they could actually enjoy maybe in a different way.
Yeah, and also, you know, a real wide variety, as she was telling us about, with sweetness levels. There's some very, very sweet hard ciders and some very, very dry hard ciders that do kind of put you more in the mood of a wine. Kevin Ring, do you think about cider pairings and other kinds of products that are perhaps making some inroads on what traditionally might be a space for wine with dinner when you have people who say, I'd like you to suggest a beer for me or a hard cider? I mean, are people moving away from wine and into other complex drinks that can also pair nicely with food?
I've been using ciders to start the meal off quite a bit lately, and it's been going over really, really, really well. Our chef tends to throw me curveballs when he writes the menu and I have to pair to it. So, you know, with the Amuse course, starting off a little small bite, and if they don't enjoy the cider, then I'm moving on to the next course and the next wine anyway. I've been getting huge positive responses with ciders, and I will give a bit of a plug. There's a local little farm in Barnard, the Fable Farm guys, and they're making some farm ciders, and their stuff is wonderful. It's the perfect New England beverage. I mean, it really is. You know, there's the industry here in Vermont, you know, working on the wine side of it, working with the cold climate wines. But the cider apples are here. We don't have to do any cold climate apples to create wonderful apple ciders, and they're great with food.
We're talking about wine today. We're looking at how wines pair with food. We're looking at holidays. And when you think about this time of year, and we're talking about wine, which is a product, but how do you think about how it fits into friends and families and dinners and the way we think about coming together at this time of year? Kevin Clayton?
I think it's one of the great things we gather around. I mean, I certainly sell coffee. I have a coffee shop, and wine... It seems to be this thing that you can put on the table and that all sorts of people from all sorts of walks of life can enjoy it the same way. And it's one of the few things I feel that bring together so many people from all different walks of life that you can sit and enjoy and talk about a glass of wine or a bottle of wine. And it's just – it's a thing that we use to gather people, and I love that part of it.
And Kevin,
no, I completely agree. I mean, I think if you look at a gathering, Thanksgiving, Christmas, or just a Thursday night dinner with your friends, there's a lot of different ingredients. You know, there's the wine, there's the food. You can have a very, very nice bottle of wine with people you don't really like in an uncomfortable situation, and it's not that memorable. You can have a really low-priced, poor-quality bottle of wine with some dear friends in a beautiful setting, and that whole experience is wonderful. It's wonderful. So, You know, I agree. I mean, I really think that it is a big part of the puzzle of enjoying it. You know, telling the stories of where the wine came from. I just gave a bottle of wine to some people I did a tasting with the other day because they're going to serve it with the oyster stew at Thanksgiving. They were blown away when I said, oh, here, take this. Tell the story. It's from Piedmont. I've sat with these people. I know them. You know, so they now have a story.
Well, that is wonderful to have a story to go along with whatever you're eating or imbibing at this holiday season. Kevin Clayton is the owner of Village Wine and Coffee in Shelburne. Kevin Ring is the wine director at Twin Farms Resort in Barnard. Thank you both for coming back, and a very happy Thanksgiving to both of you.
Happy Thanksgiving to you, Jane.
Thank you, Jane. I appreciate it.
That will do it for today. The Thanksgiving holiday weekend embodies a few big themes, a festive meal with family, perhaps a long car trip to get there, and some time to reflect, sometimes uncomfortably, on our shared history. Tomorrow on Vermont Edition, we are taking all of it on, from food to travel to history to culture. We'll get your Thanksgiving holiday started right. So tune in at noon or at 7. Vermont Edition is produced by Patty Daniels, Rick Singeri, and Sage Van Wing, with production assistance from Mary Carol Magazzini. Peter Biello directed the program, and our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.